Due to the graphic nature of this haunted place's history, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes depictions of torture, self-harm, suicide, and violence against minors. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Vigo hated the boar hide, stretched tight and nailed to the board behind the glass display case. He passed it several hundred times a day during his shifts as a tour guide at Borgard Manor. He hated the way its glass eyes seemed to follow him, no matter where he stood in the room. He hated the way the skin was displayed, as though killing was something that should be rewarded. He tried to hide his disgust when tourists made the same crude jokes. People posed with it like they had killed it themselves. Vigo was tired of looking at it, pretending that it was some charming story. Legend said that the castle walls would crumble to the ground if the skin was removed. Despite what he said to paying customers, Vigo did not give much credence to the supernatural stories around Forgard. He had never seen anything out of the ordinary. People said that the dark spot on the floor was an eternal bloodstain, but to Vigo, it just looked like rot. There was no reason to believe that this legend was any truer than the others. After the last guests left, Vigo stayed behind, sticking to the large shadows draped about the castle. He hid from the guards and crept towards the display case, housing the dead animal that disgusted him so much. He bashed the glass in with a rock, his hands stinging as he withdrew them. Blood welled on his fingers where the jagged glass shards had sliced them. Vigo reached inside and grasped the boar skin. He tore it from its mount, leaving small pieces of hide behind on the ancient nails. The ground beneath him began to rumble. Vigo wrapped the skin around himself and took off running. The earth moved beneath him, rumbling like a great beast roused from a centuries-long slumber. He rushed up the castle steps. He tripped on the last one and toppled. The skin slid across the stone. For a moment, Vigo swore he saw the hide ripple as if stretched over ancient muscles. A powerful animal laid low. Rock fell away around him. He swam in air before plummeting into the darkness below. Welcome to Haunted Places, a Parcast original. I'm Greg Polson. Every Thursday, I take you to the scariest, eeriest, most haunted, real places on Earth. You can find all episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Haunted Places for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Haunted Places in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. This week, join me on a supernatural journey to Denmark's Forgard Manor, a Renaissance-era estate that belonged to one of the country's most polarizing female leaders. Either a torturer or a philanthropist, depending on who you ask, and discover why, to this day, it's haunted. Settled on the picturesque North Jutland Peninsula, Borgard Manor, or Borgard Slot in Danish, is one of the most beautiful Renaissance-era buildings in Denmark. Its origin is shrouded in mystery, with no concrete records of how or when it was built. It's as if the castle sprung from the ground on its own, like in a fairy tale. The mounted boar skin that is believed to be the only thing standing between Borgard and total collapse adds even more to the Hans Christian Andersen ambiance. The earliest known written reference to Borgard Manor doesn't appear until 1481, but the L-shaped red brick fortress was already occupied by then. Soon after, during the first half of the 16th century, Borgard starred as the backdrop of a veritable medieval soap opera. The lord of the manor at Borgard, Stuga Krumpen, was a Catholic bishop, but as was true with many of the period's religious leaders, he was hardly devoid of sin. Krumpen took up with a noblewoman named Elsabeth Guldsteren, whose husband, a knight named Bundumunk, was in Krumpen's service at Borgard. Krumpen had always had a knack for increasing his personal wealth while avoiding the consequences of his actions. But when a war of succession erupted between the Catholic King Christian II and the Protestant future King Christian III in 1534, Krumpen found himself on the losing side. Denmark, it turned out, was pushing inexorably toward a Protestant Reformation. Krumpen's power eroded. He eventually lost his manor to a peasant revolt led by pirate revolutionary Skipper Clement that same year. When the dust settled in 1536, the Danish crown took ownership of Borgard Manor. Karen Crabb, the widow of a Danish nobleman, and her daughter Ingeborg Skeel spent several years negotiating with King Frederick II in order to purchase Borgard. They achieved their goal in 1578, though Ingeborg had been married to her husband, Ota Eriksson Banna, for 18 years, it was she who took over the duties of Lord of the Manor at Borgard. This post included acting as a judge and sheriff for the region. She was an unflinching mistress and quickly developed a reputation for swift and harsh judgments. According to one story, when an architect in charge of renovating Borgard displeased her, she ordered her guards to drown the man in the castle's moat. Practical and ruthless, Ingeborg Skeel was a woman ahead of her time. Unfortunately, a lot of nobles in the area weren't ready for the world to change. Freya loved her country more than she loved herself. Though she was merely a humble maid at Borgard, patriotism coursed through her veins, stronger than blood. There was nothing she wouldn't do to keep this castle and her country safe, which is why she had to do it. The two noblemen, Nikolai and Veldemar, had no right to speak of the Lady of the Manor the way they did. Lady Ingeborg had been chosen by King Frederick, and they dared accuse her of making pacts with the devil and all the dark forces of hell. Freya told the head housekeeper what she'd overheard. Freya had expected that the men would be imprisoned. The dungeons of the castle were particularly cruel. But Lady Ingeborg's blood ran colder than Freya realized. Perhaps the tales of her cutting off children's fingers for thieving were more than vicious rumors. Freya was told to head to the North Tower immediately. She did as she was told, expecting that there had been a spill of some sort. But the floor was clean. Instead, she found the two traitorous noblemen waiting. Nikolai and Veldemar were in chains. The Lady of the Manor herself stood before them. They both begged for Lady Ingeborg to listen to them. Why would they take the words of a servant girl over their own? Didn't they see she was lying? Freya felt her breath catch in her throat as her lady turned on her, eyes like steel. She asked if what the men said was true. Had Freya lied? No, Freya protested. She would swear in the Lord himself that they had called her lady a witch. The two men opened their mouths to speak, but before they could utter another word, Lady Ingeborg struck, slashing their throats with a long knife. Nikolai's head fell forward as his body slid slowly to the ground, only held up by the chains that bound him. Veldemar was less lucky, breathing in wet gasps until he drowned in his own blood. Red pooled in the recesses of the floor. Freya wiped flecks of red from her face. She had never seen anyone die before, and certainly hadn't expected for her own words to be the cause. A sliver of doubt crept into her brain. She had made the right decision, hadn't she? Lady Ingeborg left the chamber, and two guards carried the bodies off. Nikolai and Veldemar's dead eyes stared up at Freya. Her breath came out in stutters. Even as they moved away, their gaze lingered on her, cold and accusing. Bile rose in her throat, but she choked it down. She had done her part for her country. She should feel proud of herself. She wiped the blood off the floor with a rag. Small red flecks dotted her dress. Freya dunked her rag in the metal bucket she always carried with her and watched the water turn pink. She squeezed the cloth out between her fingers, then rubbed at the stained wood. Freya scrubbed at the floor until her hands were sore. She inspected the beams for any sign of what had happened. It was spotless. She blinked, and the pool of blood returned. A guard's voice woke her from her trance. He told her that she looked pale. She pointed to the spot on the floor. He didn't understand. Her voice quavered as she told him the blood had reappeared. He shook his head sadly and told her the first death was always the hardest. Eventually, the shock would fade. Lady Ingeborg knew what she was doing. His conscience was clear. Freya should be too. Freya knew what she had seen, but as she turned to look at the spot again, she saw what he saw. Only her gaunt reflection in the perfectly polished wood. No blood. She collected herself and hurried out of the tower, back to the comfort of her small room. Freya had done the right thing. She had. The nobleman's eyes hadn't been accusing her. They'd just been empty, devoid of life. They were in hell now, where they belonged. She tossed and turned for hours that night. Sleep evaded her grasp. Each time she closed her eyes, she saw Nikolai and Veldemar. She felt their bodies falling on top of her instead of the ground. Blood washing thickly over her face as she fought to get their weight off of her. Her eyes would open, but the crushing weight against her chest remained. She could feel their corpses sitting on top of her, a pair of ghosts whose souls weighed too much to bear. But after tossing and turning for hours, eventually blissful, dreamless oblivion finally took her. Freya woke to the sound of footsteps. She worried that she had missed the bell for work, but when she opened her eyes, it was still dark. She sat up slowly, feeling cold floor where there should have been a cot. It took several moments for her to wake up enough to place where she was. The North Tower. Freya stood up slowly. On the floor where she had slept was a large bloodstain, only visible in the dark thanks to the pale light of the moon. Her guts twisted. She felt the last remnants of her dinner travel up her throat. She tried desperately to swallow it back down. Freya brought her hands to her mouth. She felt something sticky against her skin. Blood. It covered her hands, and now it was on her face. She tried to wipe it away, but it had stained her fingers, just as it had the floor. Freya ran. She needed her wash basin and some rags, something that would clean away the evidence of this sin. She scrubbed her skin until it was red and raw. The blood washed away from her face, but it painted her hands a soft pink. As she worked through the day, cleaning the floors, she saw phantom drops of blood drip from her fingers to the floor. She asked one of the other maids if her hands were bleeding. The girl replied that they were a pristine white, softer than a maid should be, the hands of nobility. It was some sort of illusion. She was sure of it. She could still feel the cracks and calluses of her hands. A life of servitude left scars on the body. Her hands were not her own anymore. They had been replaced by those of someone with richer blood than hers. The steward summoned her to the North Tower again. She tried to keep her tremors hidden as she walked up the steps toward the wretched space that now haunted her. The moment she stepped through the doorway, the man asked why she had not done her duty. Freya followed his eyes to the stains on the floor, the ones that she'd cleaned twice already. She made her apologies and got down on her knees to deal with the spot again. But it would not go. He watched as she wiped over and over again. She apologized profusely, waiting for a blow or even the slash of a knife to punish her. But the steward told her that there was no need to apologize for being thorough. The floor looked beautiful now. She could return to her other duties. Freya looked down at the floor again, seeing Nikolai and Valdemar looking up at her from where her reflection should be. Their eyes were hard, as if they meant to leap out of the surface and strangle her. She blinked. Their faces had been replaced with their blood, pooling, oozing, flowing towards her feet. She resumed her scrubbing. The steward dragged her away from the spot. She tried to fight against his grasp. In cleaning it, she would be purified. He held her tightly, yelling that she was being insubordinate. He struck her. She went limp in his arms, and the world went black. Freya's eyes opened slowly. She was on the floor of the North Tower again. Her superior was gone. Her metal bucket was beside her. She gripped the handle. A jagged edge bit into her skin, leaving a small trickle of blood. Freya stared at her hands, an idea forming in her desperate mind. Perhaps the blood of the innocent could be cleansed with the blood of the guilty. She ran the metal rim of the bucket up and down her arm, blood dribbling out of her veins and onto the floor. Freya smeared the blood into the stain, but it did not relent. She cut more and more of her skin open, flooding the floors with her blood, trying to wash away the horrors that she had witnessed. She kept working until all she could see was blood. They found her body hours later, utterly drained in a pool of sticky red. From then on, the stain always returned. Vorgard Slott's northeastern tower has an ancient red stain on the floor. Its source has been lost to time, but some say it is the mark of the spilling of innocent blood. The manor has been renovated numerous times, and the wood floors in the room are frequently sanded down and painted again, but the stain always returns after a few days. Historians say that there are no records to corroborate the outlandish claims of cruelty lodged against Lady Ingeborg Skeel, but the blood must have come from somewhere. Whether it is the result of the murder of a betrayed Catholic or a servant who made a mistake, it is clear that Borgard Manor is not ready to forgive or forget the injustices committed within its walls. Up next, another encounter with Borgard Slott's most iconic lady of the manor, a woman so cruel and so powerful that her subjects believed she was a witch. Now, back to the story. As the 16th century drew to a close, Vorgard Manor fell into the hands of Danish noblewoman Ingeborg Skeel. Whether or not you believe the staff's claims that she still walks the halls, she remains the building's most famous and controversial occupant. In life, she was a fastidious head of household and shrewd businesswoman, dispensing her duties as the area's sheriff with a swift and sure hand. But as often happened with powerful women at the time, darker rumors began to swirl around the Lady of the Manor, including accusations of witchcraft and deals with the devil. Her cruelty quickly became a part of local folklore, but many townspeople claimed she was more than a scary story to tell at night. Maya's family was hungry. Her father had tilled the fields as he should, working day in and day out with their neighbors. But the Lady of the Manor always took their harvest. She used it to make beer in the market, while Maya and her 8 siblings starved. Maya was the oldest at 12. She had to help somehow. As the sun set that afternoon, she snuck onto the grain cart. Her conscience was clear. She was merely taking back what belonged to her family. Maya watched the dark sky, clinging to the axle below the cart, as the pack horse carried the grain beneath the imposing stone arch and into Vorgard Slott's courtyard. The sun sank below the horizon on one of the yard's 2 open sides. Maya waited for the stable hands to turn their backs, then rolled out from the other side of the cart, walking with purpose towards the closest door she could see. Hopefully, the estate had some kind of scullery maid, some small girl that belonged in the L-shaped bastion of red brick, so Maya wouldn't look out of place. Maya made it to the door with quick steps, yanking it open and sliding inside. It closed behind her on its own. She told herself it was a draft that blew the door shut. The hallway was long and cold, but mercifully empty. Her growling stomach made it easy to follow the savory smell of roasting pork belly to the kitchen. The pantry would be somewhere nearby. She would be careful and take only 1 bag of flour. Maybe some apples. And some pork. Her stomach rumbled again. She stole into the dark room, filling her bag with everything she could see. Then she doubled back down the hallway, searching for the door she'd found before. But the hallway was dark now. Too dark. It was also longer than she'd remembered. The rush of wind was hot and strangely heavy, as if she was standing in the closed maw of some great monster. She felt the beast take a deep breath. Her heart thudded heavily in her chest. She had lost her bearings. Wheeling around, she peered through the darkness, hoping to see the faint glimmer of a candle. And then, at the end of the hall, Maya saw her. A round but imposing vision, all in white. The woman's cheeks were red, her nose snubbed. Her hair was covered by a white veil, and her eyes flashed with blue fire. Maya told herself that she did not believe in witches, that her mother's stories were only stories, and that Ingeborg Skeel, the Lady of the Manor, was simply a greedy woman who thought of no one but herself. But in the darkness, her features exaggerated by the flickering torchlight, the Lady of the Manor was the monster Maya feared she would be. Rough hands grabbed her. Maya tried to struggle, to cry. But the hands carried her down, down, down into the stone depths of the castle, to the place where only her loudest screams would carry. Her bag of stolen food lay forgotten in the hallway. The guards chained her up, and she found herself face to face with Lady Skeel and her eerie glow. Maya's wrists were so small they slid through the cuffs. The men shook their heads and went to get smaller ones. Their casual talk made Maya's blood run cold. Why did they have smaller ones? Lady Skeel's voice was higher than she expected it to be, honeyed. She asked what Maya was doing in Vorgard. She knew the woman would not be fooled by lies, so she told the truth. She was hungry. Her family was hungry. The village was hungry. The witch scoffed. She had built them churches, a hospital. Where did they think that money came from? Maya did not know how to reply. She only knew what her parents had said about Lady Skeel. She didn't want to get them in trouble as well. The lady asked Maya how she entered the manor. Maya knew this was yet another trap. She was looking for an opportunity to punish someone else. Maya explained that she had flown in from the sky. The lady laughed, then slapped her. Maya's cheek stung, but she set her jaw, looking up at the grown woman. She had flown, Maya insisted, like a goose or a swan. She heard the metallic scrape of a knife being drawn from a scabbard. A guard pressed the blade to her throat, ordering her to answer truthfully. Maya told him she could not show him her feathers. They hid until they were needed. Perhaps they should throw her from the tower, the lady of the manor said. Then they'd be needed. Perhaps, Maya echoed. She tried to find the tone of defiance she used with her mother when she was truly annoyed with her. The, "I don't care and I never will," voice. The sound that came from Ingeborg Skeel was almost a growl. She paced around the room, her shadow growing and shrinking as she passed by each torch. The way she stomped and carried on made Maya sure she wasn't a witch. Witches didn't need chains, and they certainly didn't grow impatient with little girls like her. They made them do chores before cutting them into little pieces, throwing them in a pot, and eating them for dinner. Maya decided she wasn't scared anymore. A strange moment of clarity struck her. How short-sighted her torturer was being. To Maya and her family, the stolen food was another month's worth of hope. To Ingeborg, it was nothing. And in the end, Ingeborg and her great house would be nothing as well. Exhausted, Maya asked Ingeborg what harm her stealing did, why it mattered, when she had so much food and so many guards. The law was the law, Ingeborg replied. Actually, she clarified with a smirk, she was the law. Maya couldn't help but laugh. The law lived in a fortress that wasn't a fortress, had a moat that wasn't a moat. What purpose did these attempts at security mean if a dirty, half-starved girl could sneak into the kitchens unnoticed? What if she had been something worse? Even the law could be killed. Ingeborg slapped her again. Maya laughed again. History would not be kind to Lady Ingeborg Skeel. Her manor would fall to ruin, sold off, piece by piece, only to be unified by a betrayer of Denmark. She would not be able to stop it, even when she was forced to watch, wandering the halls forever. It was an idle threat with no basis. Maya was no seer. But the tiny hint of fear on her captor's face, for only an instant, was enough to comfort her. Ingeborg turned towards the door, nodding to the guards. The usual punishment. The girl would learn her place. "Please stay," Maya invited, her voice high, even innocent. "Be brave enough to see your handiwork. At least go down to the village and see the sallow skin and sunken eyes of the peasants she had starved." Ingeborg kept walking. The door shut behind her. The guards let Maya down and placed her small hand on the table, fingers spread. Maya resisted until they warned her that if she wanted to keep at least some of them, holding still was best. Maya went still, quieting her breathing. She braced for the blade, seeking the adolescent serenity of being truly, profoundly right. The guard raised his knife. Then he brought it down. Ingeborg Skeel was a controversial figure. We have records of her philanthropic actions, including the construction of several churches and a hospital. But Borgard's lore says she was a tyrant, torturing her people. However, these supposed tortures appear to have either been erased from history, or perhaps never actually happened at all. On paper, the criminal sentences she passed were no more violent than was customary for the time. Still, it's impossible to ignore the legends of a lady who cut off children's fingers when they stole grain from the fields. We do know that after she died in 1604, the manor was plagued by a presence with very clear opinions on how things were to be run. The spirit would forcefully open a door on the upper floor of the east wing and frequently blew out candles to make its displeasure known. Things got so bad that a local priest was asked to draw her spirit to a nearby swamp and exorcise her. But if modern-day reports are any indication, Ingeborg Skeel did not give up so easily. A ghostly woman in white is still seen walking the corridors, even in the morning. Because in Denmark, most of the day is spent in darkness. Coming up, we journey to Vorgard's most infamous and sinister location, the dungeon. Now, back to the story. Vorgard Slott's dungeon dates back to its original construction. Known as Rosa Dunton, the cell is cut off from fresh air and sunlight. The quarters are so small that a grown man cannot stand up straight or lie down flat in the cell. Rosa Dunton is similar to an upright coffin in its dimensions, and there is a small shaft to the floors above, where guards were once posted. The imprisoned were denied privacy as they awaited death, nearly immobilized as vermin and the cold attacked them. It was a very effective means of physical and psychological torment for the prisoners. But one can only wonder what effect it had on the men forced to listen to them. When he was younger, Johan had gazed up at the walls of Vorgard, wondering what was hiding inside them. Even as the latter half of the 19th century dawned, it remained frozen in time. Giant stone animals stood sentry over its long walkway and massive moat. He wanted to know what secrets lived within the walls, what goings-on peasants were never allowed to be a part of. It had been difficult to work his way into the manor guard. His mother had always told him that every action had a cost, either to your pocket or to your soul. His path to Vorgard was littered with both kinds. He'd given up everything he had to be part of the world of the wealthy, if only as a spectator. In return, they'd granted him a position reserved for those with a heart of steel. He'd been given a post two floors above Rosa Dunton. The castle guards boasted about the cruelty of the single-celled room. No man could stand or lay within it. There was no sunlight. A small shaft in the ceiling was the sole source of air. Rats would sneak down and chew on the prisoner as they squatted, their legs straining from the effort. Johan could hear their screams from his post. The shaft let out right next to him, making him the sole witness to the pain these prisoners endured. Even when he left his post, he struggled to sleep. When he did, the prisoner's anguish followed him through his dreams. The howls and pained cries would torment him as though he were still at work, standing stock still and trying to pretend he didn't hear the agony below him. After months of enduring the awful sounds, the Lord God gave Johan a reprieve from the cries. The man imprisoned in the cell died. However, it fell to Johan to crawl into the dungeon to retrieve the body. Rat bites covered the prisoner's limbs and face. Part of his eye had been chewed away. Johan tried not to wonder if that particular injury had happened before or after his death. When Johann reached in to remove it, he was shocked to discover the corpse was partially frozen. Unfazed, his officer handed him a saw. He would have to cut the limbs away so they could get the torso out more easily. Johann went to work, trying not to gag too noticeably. He hacked away at different spots until he could snap pieces of flesh and bone off the rest of the corpse. Johann washed himself thoroughly afterwards, but the stink of rotten flesh persisted long after they'd buried what remained of the prisoner. Sometimes the smell still filled his nostrils in the night as he passed down a dark corridor. But Rosa Dunton was empty. The worst was over. Johann had no quarrels with his position anymore. He could guard the area to the best of his ability, do his patrols easily. At night, he slept like the dead. Each morning, he awoke refreshed and ready to face the day with enthusiasm. The screams became a distant memory. How easy it was to forget the suffering of others when your own quality of life had improved. Several weeks into this newfound peace, Johann began to notice something strange. Everywhere he went, he heard the faint sound of breathing. He'd searched the corridor thoroughly, but he couldn't find the source. The breaths appeared to follow him around, sitting too close to his ear, hot and damp. Several days later, they stopped, but they were replaced by something else. A ragged moan of pain. The sound grew louder and more insistent as he did his best to ignore it. He had heard the sound before, weeks ago. It was a very specific noise, the pain of those whose muscles had cramped after hours of trying to get comfortable. The moans continued to rise through the shaft, echoing around the room. Johann had not been notified of any new prisoners. He left his post to ask the other guards if they had heard something he hadn't. But Rosa Dunton lay empty. It hadn't seen a prisoner since they removed the misshapen and half-frozen mound of flesh that was the first prisoner. One of the older guards told him not to trouble himself. Each of them heard things coming from the cell every now and then. It wasn't the castle. It was their minds, expecting cries where there were none. Best to ignore it. Johann shook his head. He was not crazy. He heard screams before he even reached his post. He picked up his pace, worried that a member of the family had been hurt. But the room was empty. The screams, however, were almost deafening. He followed the sounds to the shaft. Once again, they were emanating from down below. From Rosa Dunton. He called out, asking who was down there. It was unlikely, but possible, that someone had been put in there by mistake. By the time Johann reached his post, the screams were overwhelming, making it hard to think. They echoed in a way that made him think there might be more than one person down there. It made no sense. There was no room to house more prisoners. He called down once more. This time, something answered him, its voice faint as the breaths he had felt on his neck for weeks. A single word floating through the vast chasm of space, small but insistent. Help. Johann hesitated. He had heard the words before. All prisoners begged for mercy, a way to end their suffering. He had ignored their pleas and stood his ground. But none of the guards had heard of a new arrival to the cell. Whoever was down there wasn't supposed to be. If they were trapped, he could show them the mercy he was forbidden to show prisoners. He could help them. He must help them. Rosa Dunton was one of the oldest parts of the castle. The two floors above it muffled almost all sounds from within. Below, however, was another story. Water dripped down from archways. The wooden doors creaked, even when no one was on the other side. His own footsteps echoed loudly through the hallway. He peered inside the cell. A figure crouched near the entrance, small, bent, and broken. Maybe a child? God, he hoped it wasn't a child. Johann called out to them. He told them that he could get them out of there. They just had to be patient. He unlocked the door and held out his hand. The figure moved deeper into the darkness. Johann reached farther forward, promising that it would be all right. The figure passed through his fingers. Johann fell to the cold brick floors, scuffing the skin off his chin. Something pushed against his feet. He heard the heavy creak of the wooden door. Johann scrambled to his feet. He forgot where he was for a moment, slamming his head into the ceiling of the cell. The walls wobbled before him. They stilled as he got his bearings back. He turned his head towards the exit, but the door was shut. The figure was gone. Johann pushed against the wood as hard as he could, but it did not budge. He didn't have the space to charge at the door and open it. He couldn't do anything but squat in the darkness and yell. He screamed and cried. His throat burned. His mouth was dry as sandpaper, but he would not give up. His legs started to ache. Spasms raced up and down his limbs. He refused to be cowed by whatever had trapped him here. He stood as tall as he could, a guard still at his post. But eventually, whether it was days or hours or minutes, his voice and his body began to give out. His knees dropped to the dirt, and he begged for someone to help him. He could bear this torture no longer. As if in response, he heard a shuffling far above. Someone was at his old post. He called up, pleading, but no answer came. Perhaps the guard up above believed he was crazy as well. In 1872, Vorgaard Manor was purchased by Danish politician Pitha Brunum Scavenius. He spent the next few decades reacquiring the land that had been steadily sold off by the crown. By the time of his death in 1914, Vorgaard had become one of Denmark's most impressive estates. The manor then passed into the care of his son, Erik Scavenius, who would serve as the Danish prime minister during World War II. Like Ingeborg Skeel, Erik Scavenius was a controversial figure. He disliked populism and sought compromise with Denmark's Nazi occupiers until they dissolved the Danish government in 1943. At first, Scavenius retreated from the public eye behind the walls of Vorgaard, but he eventually sold the manor to Einar Oberbeck Clausen in 1955. He renovated the castle, transforming it into a museum to hold his late wife, Marie Henriette Chenu Lafitte's remarkable art collection. If you visit Vorgaard today, Chenu Lafitte's collection is at the forefront. You can stroll past the works of Goya, Rubens, Raphael, and El Greco, or visit for one of the castle's special events. The manor is stunning when decked out for Christmas, or done up to emulate its past for medieval days in the high summer. It's very family-friendly. But the boar skin is still there, as is the bloodstain that will never be clean. The staff still swear Ingeborg Skeel walks the halls at night and cries echo from the Rosa Dunton down below. For no amount of beauty, however great or small, can erase the blood and pain that has soaked into Vorgaard's very foundation, or silence the screams of those who have suffered within its walls. The Christmas displays at Vorgaard benefit greatly from the deep darkness that Northern Europe is known for, even during the day. It means you can enjoy the lights without having to be at the manor at the witching hour. Let's just hope the ghosts know it's still day as well. Thanks again for tuning into Haunted Places. We'll be back on Thursday with a new episode. For more information on Borgard Manor, amongst the many sources we used, we found the reporting of the Copenhagen Post extremely helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Haunted Places, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Haunted Places on Spotify, just open the app and type Haunted Places in the search bar. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Haunted Places was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Carly Madden. This episode of Haunted Places was written by Lil D. Ritter and Jennifer Ishay, with writing assistance by Drew Cole. I'm Greg Polson.